Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Frederick Clarkson of Political Research Associates, who discusses the little-known Project Blitz he exposed that advocates the adoption of a Christian nationalist agenda in state legislatures across the U.S. Sean Sweeney, coordinator of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, who explains why he believes that a transition to renewables is only possible if the world converts to publicly owned energy production. And Nathan Schneider, assistant professor in media studies at the University of Colorado, who discusses his recent article titled, "A Populism of Hope Begins When People Feel Their Own Power." But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Islamic State is making a comeback in Iraq just 7 months after being forced out of Iraqi cities and the government declaring victory over the terrorist group. A new round of assassinations, kidnappings, and bombings by ISIS militants is now occurring in mostly remote areas. The attacks are reminiscent of ISIS tactics in the years before 2014 when the group captured major cities and vast areas of territory. Hisham al-Hashimi, an Iraqi counterterrorism expert based in Baghdad, maintains that it was inevitable that the Islamic State would attempt a comeback after its defeat. But he said, they are returning faster than anticipated. That they have returned this fast is very dangerous. He blames the government's failure to deliver aid and reconstruction to an area that was among the first to be freed from Islamic State control, but has seen little in the way of assistance. Iraqi state forces, backed by U.S. airstrikes, have launched operations over the past 2 weeks aimed at rooting out the militants, and they have claimed some success. A recent operation by Iraqi and Kurdish forces destroyed an Islamic State safe haven that had emerged in mountains near the town of Makmur. But ISIS has succeeded in instilling fear among the Iraqi people that the stability they thought had been won may just be a mirage. Debbie Sims Africa, a prominent member of the black radical group MOVE, walked out of prison near Philadelphia in June. She was the first of a group known as the MOVE 9 to be released for what her supporters claim is the unjust conviction for killing a Philadelphia police officer in 1978. Under orders from Philadelphia's Mayor Frank Rizzo, often accused of being a racist, hundreds of Philadelphia police officers in SWAT gear laid siege to the MOVE house in August 1978. During the siege, police officer James Ramp was killed after shooting broke out. 9 MOVE members, including Debbie Africa and her husband Mike Davis Africa, were blamed for Officer Ramp's death. But witnesses say Ramp may have been killed by friendly fire from another police officer. In 1985, a Philadelphia police helicopter dropped an incendiary bomb on MOVE's headquarters, killing MOVE's leader John Africa and 5 children. According to the Guardian newspaper, the release of Debbie Africa, who is now on parole, is a breakthrough for the MOVE 9 and other black militants imprisoned in the 1960s and 70s. 25 men and women belonging to MOVE or the Black Panther Party remain in prison, in some cases almost 50 years after their arrests. In an effort to end affirmative action in college admissions, the Trump administration has rolled back Obama-era guidelines that encouraged colleges to use race as a factor in admissions. Trump has nominated conservative federal appeals court judge Brett Kavanaugh to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy, who had written the majority opinion in a 2016 case upholding affirmative action by one vote. A lawsuit is also now challenging Harvard University's preferences for blacks and Latinos for what they claim comes at the expense of Asian Americans. But at the same time, there is a new push on college campuses to end legacy admissions, used to ease admission for children of alumni and large donors. According to ProPublica, children of alumni make up 22% of all accepted white student applicants at Harvard, compared to just 7% of black and Latino students. Student activists at a dozen elite universities are now demanding the closing down of legacy admissions. Many of the nation's most prestigious universities defend legacy admissions as a reward to loyal alumni for their volunteer work and financial donations, portraying the system as merely a tiebreaker between applicants of equal merit. But court filings, including Harvard's internal reports, show otherwise. Overall, across 6 years, Harvard accepted more than 33% of legacy applicants versus 5.9% of non-legacies. President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner is one example of why legacy admissions have drawn such criticism. Harvard accepted Kushner despite an undistinguished high school record after his father, who was not an alumnus, pledged a $2.5 million gift. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Conservative Christian evangelicals have been an important part of the Republican Party coalition since 1980, when Ronald Reagan unexpectedly defeated Jimmy Carter in the presidential election that year. For nearly 40 years, the Christian right has held a critical seat at the table when the GOP formulates its policy positions on a wide range of social issues, including same-sex marriage, abortion, and transgender bathroom assignments. According to exit polls, some 81% of Christian evangelicals voted for Donald Trump in 2016, and a recent Public Religion Research Institute poll conducted in March found that 75% of white evangelicals surveyed still had a positive opinion of the president. Since 2016, Republicans control all branches of the federal government. They're in charge of 32 state legislatures and hold all levers of power in 26 states that also elected GOP governors. With Republicans' current lopsided hold on political power across the nation, the Christian right is very much aware of this unique moment in political history and heavily focused on winning legislative battles while they can. Your reporter spoke with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow with Political Research Associates and author, who talks about Project Blitz, a sophisticated operation he recently exposed that has written model legislation and is now pushing for the adoption of Christian nationalist-inspired laws in state legislatures across the U.S.
Well, I can't say I did it entirely myself. A friend happened to stumble across it and said, I better tell Fred about this, knowing that I've been doing work on religious freedom-related issues for a long time. And sure enough, you visit the website, and you can still find it there to this day, I think. There was a kind of buried in the website, a little hard to find, but it's there, hidden in plain sight, this 116-page strategy manual that offers 20 model bills about various aspects of the Christian right agenda, all under the rubric of religious freedom. So there's everything there from model bills that would allow or require schools to post In God We Trust in the public schools. Other things would have be resolutions that state legislatures could pass allowing honoring Religious Freedom Day. But the more serious kinds of things are model legislation that would seriously affect the civil rights, particularly of gay and lesbian people, by legalizing many of the things that were at issue in the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision the Supreme Court decided today. So if you were a business, that you would, as a matter of religious conscience, not have to serve gay people. There's also a bill that would allow religious institutions not to be involved in adoption or foster care services for same-sex couples. And it goes down the line in that way. So it's a very serious and very considered legislative package. And I say that because they've taken the time to study what's gone on around the country, seen what's worked and hasn't worked, and to seriously learn from what has been happening so that they can do better going forward. And it comes complete with talking points and the general vision of the legislative strategy and resources to back up the legislative proposals if they're made. So it's a really remarkable document, and I have to say in 30-plus years of doing research in this area, I've never seen anything like it.
Well, Fred, since you've written your article in late April, and it's gotten some publicity here in the U.S., in the U.S. press, not as much as it deserves, of course, but what's the response of some civil society groups who are certainly finding themselves on the opposite side of this Project Blitz Christian right agenda? And what, if anything, is percolating in terms of organizing opposition to this Christian nationalist agenda in state legislatures?
Well, we're at a very early stage, but I will say that groups like the Interfaith Alliance and Americans United for Separation of Church and State are very concerned about it and want to do something, as does the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. My organization, Political Research Associates, organized a webinar a week or so ago with the Public Rights Private Conscience Project at the Columbia Law School and Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and got about 80 leaders to participate in that to begin to get a grounding of what this means, what's new and what's different here, and how should we begin to think about it. And I'll be involved in a similar kind of webinar on Wednesday, beginning to speak to LGBTQ activist groups involved in the states who are understandably interested and concerned and beginning to get their minds around it too. So I think we will be seeing state and national interest groups figuring it out. State legislative sessions are pretty much over for this year, but there's time to think about what to do for next year, and I think that's what we'll all be thinking about.
That was Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow with Political Research Associates and author. Find a link to Clarkson's widely read recent article titled "Project Blitz Seeks to Do for Christian Nationalism What ALEC Does for Big Business" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 24th, a group of Connecticut-based climate activist organizations sponsored a conference titled A Teach-In for a Livable World, Climate Justice Now. One of the speakers at the West Hartford gathering was Sean Sweeney, coordinator of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, a global organization that promotes publicly owned renewable energy resources. Sweeney began his presentation by maintaining that many climate scientists, NGOs, and trade unions have bought into the conventional wisdom that a transition of renewables is inevitable, especially after British climate negotiator Nicholas Stern popularized the idea that individuals and businesses must pay to pollute, and that paying more for dirty energy will inevitably reduce greenhouse gases. Here, Sweeney discusses why such an outcome has not materialized in the 20 years since the Rio Climate Summit, and why he believes a transition to renewables is not inevitable going forward unless the world converts to public ownership of energy production. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended and recorded Sweeney's talk and presents the following excerpts.
The labor movement was attending these climate talks very much in a small minority. It's not a top priority. It wasn't then and it isn't now for the labor movement, who are struggling to survive, not just in this country, but elsewhere. But they took the view, and I think they should be acknowledged for their role in this, that the science was important. There was no negotiating with these emissions reduction trajectories, that this was necessary. And what workers needed to do, or workers' representatives, was to make sure that workers didn't actually get thrown under the bus by these reductions. If there were going to be reductions in emissions, that's going to affect energy-intensive industries, and that will mean workers will lose their jobs. So the emphasis was on just transition, a term that grew up in the U.S. trade union movement with the oil, chemical, and atomic workers under the leadership of the late Tony Mazzocchi back in the 1980s. So just transition was the demand, and on top of that was green jobs, because if we needed a low-carbon future and these aggressive science targets were necessary, that's going to create tens of millions of jobs around the world, So we want those jobs, and we want them to be good jobs. So these were the basic demands. But it never challenged the idea that the transition itself was inevitable. In fact, many union leaders said, this is going to happen, we have to be prepared for the future, etc., etc. Let's go to 2009 and the Copenhagen Accord. The United States, with a number of other countries, decided that a legally binding agreement on emissions reductions was not necessary. This was the Obama administration, not the Trump administration. Obama said that every country should put on the table a pledge, what they think they can do, and then we will review that pledge against the science. And so the Copenhagen Accord changed the whole legal architecture of the global climate talks to one which was a pledge and review voluntary agreement. So this set is the stage for the rather important moment in trade union history, in my view, which was in 2012, was the 20th anniversary of the Rio Summit, the Earth Summit of 1992. In 2012, it was again in Rio, and there was a big conference hall of unions, just unions, saying, what are our demands at this Earth Summit? And the issue of climate change and the green economy came up, of course, was the main focus of this of the trade union assembly. And something very significant happened there. I was privileged enough to be in the room. The United Nations Environment Programme, the various agencies, the World Bank, got up and addressed this trade union audience and said, the transition to a low carbon economy is inevitable. And all we need to do is make sure that we are trying to have a just transition and we can leave it to market forces to address this problem called climate change. The reaction was very, very angry from the group. These were mostly unions from Latin America, but there were also very many representatives from unions from around the world. And they said, you've got to be kidding me. Essentially, the International Energy Agency has said that from 1990 to 2012, that emissions had gone up 61%. Now think of that in historical terms. We're talking about a brief moment in history, 20 or so years, and emissions going up 61%. That was 2012. Since then, they've continued to rise. They've slowed down a little bit, but they've gone up again this year. So emissions keep going up. So where is this transition to a low-carbon economy? The unions also said, everywhere we go, particularly in the global south, extractionism is running rampant. Fracking, drilling, mining, mountaintop removal. Basically, extrajudiciary killing, assassinations of environmental and trade union leaders who oppose this agenda. So there was a resolution was developed on the floor that said that there needed to be a reclaiming and defense of the commons, that the market could not produce a sustainable economy or a sustainable ecological situation, and that we had to reclaim to the public what had been privatized, particularly in the energy sectors. And extractionism had to stop. There's no point saying that, you know, we can just sort of have a few incentives and market signals to get ourselves out of this. Meanwhile, of course, the carbon price that Nicholas Stern said was going to be introduced was tried in Europe. And it was supposed to be in place now globally at the level of around about $100 a ton. In the ensuing 12 years, only 13% of global emissions are priced. When we look at interrogate the economics of renewable power, what we see is this. The single most expensive part of it is the borrowing of capital. We need to lower the cost of capital. How do we do that? The best thing to do is not have private companies do it. Have public renewable energy companies established.
That was Sean Sweeney, coordinator of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy and director of the International Program on Labor, Climate, and Environment at the Murphy Institute, City University of New York. The preceding talk was recorded at a February 24th teach-in sponsored chiefly by 350.org Connecticut and the Connecticut chapter of the Sierra Club. Learn more about the movement promoting publicly owned renewable energy resources by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Contemporary peace and social movements in the U.S., from the millions who rallied to fight for civil rights and racial justice, and those that mobilized to oppose the Vietnam War and subsequent American interventions abroad, often look to history for guidance on how to effect change. In a recent article, Nathan Schneider, assistant professor in media studies at the University of Colorado and author, examined some of the lessons today's progressive activists can learn from the populist movements of the late 19th century. In his article titled, "A Populism of Hope Begins When People Feel Their Own Power," Schneider recounts how white and black farmers from the American South and West revolted against the financial power of urban robber barons that included financier J.P. Morgan, steel magnate Andrew Carnegie, and Standard Oil's John D. Rockefeller. Schneider notes that it was not grievances against an unfair economic system alone that stimulated the farmers' movement to grow and go on to win victories. Rather, he points out, that the farmers' creation of cooperatives served as an engine of counter-economy, which became a source of inspiration and a means of material support. Farmers of the populist era, who eventually made common cause with the largest labor union of that time, used their cooperatives, known as the Farmers' Alliance, to bypass the economic monopolies of the robber barons, using their collective power to purchase supplies, sell their products, and extend credit to their own members. Your reporter spoke with Nathan Schneider, who explains why he believes that popular social movements through history have needed to create their own alternative systems and models of empowerment in order to inspire success.
Turning back to that moment really started for me the morning after the election of Donald Trump as president. I'd had for some weeks a book on my bedstand called The Populist Moment by Goodwin, and just that title kind of grabbed me after that election and made me curious to go back to other populist moments, moments where people in one form or another turned against an elite. And what I found in that story was a very different kind of populist moment, a very, very different one, one that arose out of a lot of the same concerns. In the late 19th century, it was not financialization of everything in Silicon Valley and automation and globalization. It was railroads and oil and urban bankers. And the ways that people resisted first began with developing their own economic alternatives, developing cooperatives, developing their own tools and organizations, unions in the city, especially through the Knights of Labor in the countryside. It was through the Grange or the Farmers Alliance. And what resulted in the form of the Populist Party in the late 1880s and early 1890s was a populism that was fueled by people's sense of their own power, their own capacity to change the world around them through those economic alternatives. And it resulted in a really different set of policies, a more hopeful set of ambition. And, you know, one example of that is in 1893, the year after the populace elected their own governor to the state of Colorado here, Colorado became one of the first states to pass women's suffrage. That's one of many ways in which this movement envisioned a much more hopeful future than I think the populism of today does.
Nathan, turning to the contemporary scene where so many people have reached their limits and are quite upset and angry about their economic futures and their children's economic futures in this current system. What is going on today that you feel parallels some of the creative institution building that was going on in the populist era? Are there contemporary examples of new movements that have developed? I would just point to two that I'm familiar with, and our listeners maybe because they've been guests on this program over the years, and that is Gar Alperovitz, a professor, has joined with other people in terms of forming something they call the Democracy Collaborative. And Richard Wolff, who has a radio show and is widely known for his groundbreaking work on progressive economic alternatives, he's got an organization called Democracy at Work. Those are just two examples, and I'm sure you have many more that you can share with us.
Absolutely. There's a new generation of people who are pouring into this cooperative movement, turning to it almost as if they're starting by scratch often. And this is really the subject of my next book, which is coming out later this year, called Everything for Everyone. And it's a kind of chronicle of the movement that I've been exploring since seeing it emerge out of Occupy Wall Street and the movement, the protest movements of that period, where groups from Occupy Wall Street, from the movements around Europe that came around the same time, out of Black Lives Matter, you had people, young people, turning to this cooperative model again, and they're finding success all over the country. Cities all over the country are starting to implement the necessary enabling policies to help support worker ownership at a moment where workers are being kind of pressed from all sides. And we see a lot of new formations starting to emerge. I've been working very much in the realm of what we call platform cooperatives, which is cooperative models in the online economy. And so, you know, every day I'm talking with entrepreneurs around the world who are trying to build successful online businesses that really put people first before investor profits. And it's really exciting to see that. One organization I would add to your list there is the New Economy Coalition, which has become in the United States a really vital container for this kind of work. And one thing that they do really well, I think, is put a range of issues at the center, especially racial justice, gender justice, a range of concerns in addition to economic democracy that help these kinds of models really address the vital concerns that people are facing right now.
That was Nathan Snyder, professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder and author of Thank You Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse, and God in Proof. Find a link to Snyder's articles and essays by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. Segments in today's program were previously broadcast. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBDY in Binghamton, New York, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KEXP in Seattle, Washington, and more than 60 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.